Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Ohio ranks average when it comes to the overall system of public education, but it leads the pack in the number of low-performing public schools that fail. Unfortunately, when those schools close, students, especially minority and poor students, don't have a lot of options. These circumstances are part of long-term issues in the state's public school system. State Superintendent of Public Instruction at the Ohio Department of Education, Paolo Di Maria, has grappled with those issues at the top since May 2016. He joins us now for the hour. Welcome to the show.
Great to be with you, Ann.
When you started the job in 2016, what was your top priority then?
Well, you know, I think I came into a situation where, you know, the state had just transitioned through a couple of iterations of a new testing structure. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of people that felt like there were some frustrations anytime you go through that kind of transition. A lot of people were looking for stability and focus and maybe even just some attention being paid to some strategic issues. And so, I mean, my number one priority at that time was just to listen. I wanted to get a better feel from people about how they were feeling, what they were thinking about the current state of the education system, and begin to identify maybe some areas that needed some work and some improvement and make some progress in those areas.
So what did you come up with?
Well, you know, I mean, it was interesting because at the time, we were also beginning the process of responding to the new federal legislation, the Every Student Succeeds Act, which, again, you know, the federal government on the one hand, many of the requirements that were in place under No Child Left Behind stayed in place, the basic requirements for our assessment system and things like that. But they were going to give us some new authority in terms of school improvement, the kinds of things that we can do to help underperforming schools. And so one of the things that we did was we launched a survey. We did some we went to 10 different places across the state and did a little bit of a listening tour to get people's input and feedback. And I think it was in the context of that work that I really began to get a sense for how people were feeling, what were their reactions to different components. And, you know, different themes emerged as part of that process.
When you held that listening tour, what kinds of people show up to those things?
Well, you know, you get the whole range, you know, teachers and educators, but also members of the community. You had parents. There were even some students that showed up, you know, because we promoted it as a way that here's an opportunity that the federal government has given us. Again, it wasn't intended to be a place where every policy issue and permutation was going to be addressed, but a handful of key areas were on the table. Come forward and talk about your point of view on these different things. And so it was a great great opportunity to get that first impression about how things were going in Ohio.
And what were the larger themes that emerged for you?
Well, you know, one of the things, again, as we continue to see it a little bit, is around testing. Mm. And the fact that, you know, if you think about, you know, 30 years ago when we started the testing system, you know, we've really come a long way from that. And it seems like we've added tests. And I think people finally got to the point of saying, look, we just can't simply keep adding assessments and the time that takes, both in terms of preparation and administration and so forth and so on. And so can we be more rational? I think people understand that testing plays a role in the work that we do in education, but can we bring some take a step back and reassess what we're doing and how we're doing it? So that was one of the key themes. I think there was another key theme had to do with teacher evaluation and, you know, the way data was being factored in and the different components of teacher evaluation. So that was an area that we paid some attention to.
No Child Left Behind, Every Student Succeeds Act. I mean, these are euphemisms that are bandied about periodically over the decades now, from where I sit. And I start to wonder, from covering it, and you and I mentioned before we went on the air, it's a lot of it's the same old, some different things, but a lot of the very same issues as I was covering 30 years ago in the Ohio General Assembly, and you know, is a up-and-coming budget, you know, mm-hmm. Someone on the budget team for the administration of then-Governor George Voinovich. I just wonder if there's some kind of existential obstacle to improving public education now. Is there something so deep-rooted that it can't get much better?
I don't think so. I mean, in some ways, I think if you really you know, follow what has happened in that 30-year period, I mean, there's been a lot more attention paid to defining what we want students to know and are able to do. I'm just coming off a recent, you know, I did some back-to-school visits. I was in Cincinnati at three schools, Columbus, been to some of the rural areas. And I'm amazed at what they're even doing in the earliest grades. They're start, you know, they cover content that I think back, and of course, I don't have perfect memory about what I learned in kindergarten or first grade. But I feel like they're actually, you know, further along and at a higher level of performance. And the kids are handling. I mean, this is, I think, always the amazing thing that surprise. It doesn't surprise me because I think I've come to understand that kids are amazing, period. And that they are, you know, if we hold them to high expectations, or if we put them in a situation where they can, where we give them the supports to do great learning, they will, in fact, learn. And so I think, you know, we are better educating students better and better all the time than we ever have before. At the same time, we also understand that the world is changing and the realities. I mean, you look at some of these, you know, things that show us what professions are going to be automated, you know, whole swaths of jobs right now that are going to go away by virtue of, you know, either robots or technology automation and so forth and so on. And increasingly, employers want students with even higher levels of knowledge and skills. And so the system begins to say, OK, well, we need to put ourselves in the position of helping students acquire those higher levels of knowledge and skills. Otherwise, I mean, the data is pretty clear that if you don't, you know, if you have all you have is a high school diploma, or even if you don't have a high school diploma, the, you know, all the outcomes, you know, the likelihood of you being able to weather a recession, even your health outcomes, even your lifespan are all negatively affected. And so the more you learn, the more you're going to earn, the more all sorts of outcomes are going to work to your benefit. So I think the system continues over that 30-year period to sort of recalibrate itself and say, hey, look, we have to change as the times are changing and make sure that we set expectations that students can succeed in that the increasing demands that the employer community is putting on and that life itself is, you know, creating for folks.
It used to be the employer community did their own training, that they that was part of the deal. And a lot of people, even when you went up into, you know, white collar like jobs, they would send you to school and they'd further the training. That's changing.
Yeah, I think so. And in some ways, I think it's changing for the better, because I think employers are increasingly wanting to partner with education because they understand that they have got, you know, to fill these jobs. And the more they can do earlier in the process to help students get equipped with those knowledge and skills, the better off they're going to be. So we're seeing many, many places across the state building stronger relationships in having career focused educational programs. This doesn't necessarily mean it's a vocational ed program or a career tech program per se, but we see high schools, you know, creating for themselves a career theme that then they join together with a local business or a cluster of businesses around that particular theme. Maybe it's advanced manufacturing, maybe it's health services, maybe it's you know, criminal justice or what have you. And that it does a couple of things. One is it creates that linkage between employers and the education community and a logical stream of potential, you know, you know, workers and others, as well as people that may go into higher education in those fields. But then it also gives that that student a much more engaging setting in which to learn. Because this is what we're finding, especially in high schools, is that, you know, if I teach you algebra in the abstract, or we're having an English class and it's all in the abstract, if we can make it relevant, kids are a lot more excited. And so we're seeing that happening. You know, Akron's doing some great things. Cincinnati's doing some great things. Cleveland's been doing some great things of creating these high schools that have a thematic focus. And you're seeing kids that are more engaged and they're learning these ideas, math, English, whatever, in the context of those particular focus areas.
Yeah, and that's been an ongoing debate, and there's all kinds of complaints about the new math, and we went through them back when we were little kids going through school too, right? That's always going to be something new and different. But it seems like, I mean, for instance, 800 third graders failed to achieve the reading test scores they needed to advance to the fourth grade this year in Columbus City schools alone. Obviously, it's a huge system and, you know, you're going to have those larger numbers anyway. But it seems like what the districts fail at routinely are the reading and the writing and the arithmetic. Those are where the scores are at the outset. They're struggling.
Well,
the
you know,
same
I mean,
old, same old.
Yeah, although I don't... I think let's be fair about characterizing these because, you know, you think about Ohio, we've got 614 different school districts in lots of different communities, lots of different situations, you know, and it's a challenge when students come to the classroom at different starting points. And mm-hmm. I think this is some of the challenge that we see, you know, we see it in urban areas. We might see it in rural areas with high poverty, even in some other areas where you may not expect to find it. You see it a little bit, you know, so it's all about the students and making sure the students get what they need. And so I think especially in those early years, if a student is starting behind, it's going to take the system a little bit longer. I think we are getting better and better all the time
at catching up.
Helping students catch up. Yeah, I think that's true. But, you know, you have to look at every student and what they bring, you know, and address their own particular needs. And I think we're seeing ourselves able to do that better and better all the time. The challenges don't necessarily go away. If you look at the data about childhood poverty, you know, and then add to that maybe the English language learners increasingly that we see in Ohio. And
add to that the technology gap that poor kids struggle
right,
with.
Right, right. Those kinds of issues. You also have, you know, we're doing a better job in identifying students with autism and things like that. So, I mean, you have this range. And again, I believe that the education system is stepping up and so that the numbers are getting better. But at the same time, you know, we've got, you know, work to do. And the education system is not new to the idea of continuous improvement, always looking for ways to get better and doing better by the students that are in our care.
What's your sense about why lawmakers, why at the top, at the federal level, that the issue always turns to testing and evaluations?
Well, you know, in fairness, I think it's a sense of accountability. You know, people often say, "Well, why do we have these report cards? Why do we have these testings?" And I think the state and the federal government have a legitimate interest in wanting to understand how well the system is performing. And so it comes to developing these kinds of tools. Now,
lots of them.
Right. So that's the exact question that we debate now. It's like, do we do that too much? Do we do it in the right ways? Is it, you know, becoming more formative? You know, is it being intended to, you know, be more helpful than it necessarily is to summarize what's happening? And in fact, you know, I think as people dig into the fundamental purposes of state testing, and some of which is required at the federal level, you see that it really is more about summative. What we really, you know, or summarizing what the system looks like. What we really want teachers and school buildings to be focused on is, you know, doing the kinds of assessments that's much more meaningful to to informing instructional practice and what good instructional practice looks like. And I think that's why we're going through some of these discussions about how do we step back a little bit from the amount of time that students are spent testing using, you know, state standardized tests and really allowed that, you know, instructional time to be the beneficiary of those kinds of adjustments.
Teachers have felt lost in the mix in all of this for a very long time. They've been given a tough rap in the last decade or so, as far as I'm concerned. A lot of criticism of teachers. What is your sense about that and where they fall into the equation of success?
Well, I think it's terribly misplaced. You know, I interact with teachers when I'm out and about visiting schools, and you know, I'm always impressed. I'm always impressed by what teachers bring to the classroom, by their commitment, their dedication, their knowledge.
You'd have to be in this day and age.
What they understand, you know, what they understand about, you know, learning science and so forth and so on. I mean, I think as people were, you know, contemplating, well, what could be wrong with the system, you know, their minds went to teachers. And unfortunately, we hear about these small number of instances where maybe teachers aren't, you know, performing at levels of expectation. But, you know, increasingly, to me, the vast majority of teachers are professionals. They're doing their work. They have a real commitment to their students. They care about their students. They're working hard to improve. And I think what we've perhaps failed to do is really support those teachers in identifying, you know, evidence-based practices that are likely to have the best impact on the students that they have in their care and custody in their classrooms. And I think we're beginning to see much more of that. Some of that's about building level leadership. Some of it's about district level leadership. Some Some of it's about helping people see what evidence-based good practices look like, you know, creating communities where people can, you know, help each other and support each other. So many times we think about teaching as being a very isolated profession. You're in your classroom, but we really want people to be collaborative. And we're seeing, you know, much, much more of that happening. I'm a cheerleader out there for teachers because they're the single biggest, you know, impact on student learning that happens in schools. And we, you know, this system can't function without them, and the system can't improve without them. And we need them at the table. We need to listen to their ideas. We need to respect their professionalism. But at the same time, they're not afraid of their own, you know, accountability. And I think that's what we see as a natural disposition of teachers, always looking for ways to improve and identify, you know, what's working with kids, what's not working, and how do we keep getting better.
My guest is the State Superintendent of Public Instruction at the Ohio Department of Education, Paolo DiMaria. If you have a question or comment for Paolo DiMaria, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can check out our Facebook page, too, and post your question or comment there. Coming up, we're going to talk about charter schools. We're going to talk about the Electronic Classroom of Tomorrow, better known as ECOT. We're going to talk about all kinds of stuff. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about public education in Ohio, public K through 12 education, maybe I should clarify. Still with us is the State Superintendent of Public Instruction at the Ohio Department of Education, Paolo DiMaria. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're a longtime backer of charter schools and vouchers. You were an executive assistant to, I believe, or correct me if I'm wrong, but you were in the Voinovich administration back when vouchers were first introduced.
Right, right.
The Akron Beacon Journal last week reported that Ohio has the most failed charter schools in the nation, but fewer of them are closed. Why do you think that Ohio has this failed trajectory? And bearing in mind, there are great charter schools
right,
out there,
that's the
and
thing,
we know
right?
that, and we can talk about that, and I want to.
Yeah.
But for now, I mean, Ohio is, a year or so ago, called the laughing stock of the charter school industry in the whole country. Yeah. What's going on?
Yeah, so I want to get back to that point because, you know, so many times people, when I talk, I try to be very precise that we shouldn't broad brush anything, right? And we tend to do that with charter schools. It's like, well, they're all bad. And sometimes the same thing happens around urban education. Mm-hmm. And since I have experience in both those camps, I try to be the person that sets people straight. I sent my kids K-8 to Columbus Public Schools at a time when it was not, you know, it did not have a very high grade on the report card, but my kids got a great education. And then for high school, I sent them to a charter school, the Graham School here in Columbus,
which is
they got a great education. So,
right.
So I think it starts with great educations can exist in many settings, but then also the contrary is true that you can find places where there is poor education.
But is Ohio so?
Well, I've
done such a poor job.
Yeah, I mean, so I think it goes back to the original legislation that said, hey, look, we're going to start down this path and really not having a lot of guardrails around that. And so the next thing you know, anybody that felt like they could operate a school, you know, said, hey, you know, I'll get into this business. And the next thing you know, because people think sometimes that running a school is easy. It's not. It is super hard. It is super hard. And, you know,
sometimes it's expensive and it's hard.
It is expensive. And people go into it thinking, oh, well, you know, here's a space, here's some kids, I've got some people that want to be teachers, and let's start a school. And it just doesn't work that way. So I think as we've gotten a little bit tighter on the policy front, you're beginning to see more schools are closing, more school, it's narrowing, the successful schools are flourishing and beginning to, you know, expand. And, you know, each of the last several years, we've been closing a good number of schools. And I think that's beginning to make a difference. At the same time, the reports are always, you know, they're lagged a little
yep.
bit. And, you know, you haven't seen that yet. And we've got some, you know, we've got some ways to go. But that said, I think we're on the right path.
So, as you mentioned, your own kids attended both public and charter. One of the most successful charters, the Graham family. of schools. What in the management of Graham do you think they have right? What do they do right that makes a difference?
Well, you know, it's
if you could replicate it.
Yeah, it's the same thing that any public school does right. They are solidly focused on what the curriculum is, what does the instructional program really look like. They're concerned about the needs of their kid, meeting the needs of the whole child, not just, you know, you're here for academics. It's the culture that they establish is fantastic. Kids are interacting. They have, you know, town meetings where all the kids come together and they talk about the challenges they face. They create a real culture of, you know, we're here, we're committed to academics, we're committed to excellence. Their teachers are, you know, have that level of commitment. I think that they have a strong leadership team that makes a real difference in terms of setting that. So, I mean, if I find, you know, high schools in Columbus Public or in other parts of the state, I'm likely to see that, you know, a similar combination. They're all going to be different. This is the thing I love about education. Like, but it's about leadership. It's about instructional programming and curriculum. It's about your teachers. It's about the school culture, both among the adults in the building as well as among the students. It's about support services, making sure you're understanding and addressing the needs of kids. And if you're attentive to those things, even though it may be different in each different school, you're likely to have a successful outcome.
Back when charters and vouchers were introduced, the whole idea of using public money to fund private enterprise in schools, there was the idea that if you put some competition out there, the traditional public schools will step up to the plate. They'll get better. In your opinion, are there any good examples of that out there?
You know, I think I can't tell you that I've read all the latest research, but I think I've heard that there are a couple of studies that do show a little bit of a relationship there, but not significant. I think if the expectation was there would be huge, you know, it would drive huge changes, it has not had that particular effect. But I think there are people that talk about, you know, are we doing the best that we can in the context of our particular school building or in our district in order to make sure that the citizens in our community find the educational experience to be attractive? I think in some places, even, you know, the private school community has done that for years, and people have, you know, have understood that they shouldn't simply be resigned that, you know, private schools are always going to be better, because that doesn't have to be the case either. So I think, you know, this, if anything, what we see, or at least what I see more and more of, is people constantly asking the question, are we being the absolute best that we can be, and what do we need to do to keep getting better?
The electronic classroom of tomorrow now wants to switch game pieces, is the way I'm looking at it, to become a dropout recovery school after 17 years as a general education charter. I know there is a process that's going to have to be gone through to grant approval at the state level. What do you think about it?
So, and you know, we're in litigation with the Electronic Classroom of Tomorrow, so I'm really not going to answer any questions.
Any questions? Even it doesn't have anything to do with that, though.
If we, you know, if you want to rephrase your question in a way that's sort of generic,
what about a school, a general education charter wanting to switch to a dropout recovery school to avoid being seen as a failing school? Because the standards are lower for those dropout recovery schools.
So why don't we just start talking about dropout recovery schools as a rule? You know, because people might, the first question people might say is, well,
what is that?
What is a dropout? Why do we even have them? Right?
It's the end of the
line. And in some ways, right? It's I mean, it says it all in its name. We know that we have a dropout problem in this state and in this country, and so policymakers have said, okay, well, is there a way, you know, what are the different strategies that might be effective in terms of two things? One is, can we decrease the number of dropouts, either prevent students who are likely to be dropouts from not, you know, and make sure they stay in school, or dropout recovery, which is someone who has dropped out, can we get them back into school? Can we give them the education they need to ultimately get their high school diploma and then be better prepared for what comes afterwards? So I think, you know, the state laws have established, both in the setting of traditional public schools as well as in the community school sector, the opportunity for districts and schools to create dropout prevention and recovery programs targeting that specific population with that specific goal. Now, you know, the reality is these are really hard to serve groups of students because they are at risk of dropping out. And so they either have, you know, a poor track record of success in school in the past, or they're dealing with, you know, crises or issues within their lives and so forth and so on. And so, you know, again, everything about how to become a dropout prevention and recovery program, what the processes are, what the, you know, and then what the expectations are, you know, spelled in, out in state statute. And one of the many responsibilities we have at the Department of Education is to, you know, facilitate the processes of the normal course of business of people, you know, deciding that they want to pursue a particular model in the, you know, that's specified in the education laws of the state.
I just wonder about the other students that are already in a general education program, and then it switches to a dropout recovery. What does that mean for everybody else? How does the quality of the education, how does what's delivered to the other students change?
Yeah, I mean, you know,
has it happened before? No, I don't think so.
Well, I can't say that I've really looked at the historic data to understand whether it's happened before or not. But the bottom line is there are provisions in state law that, you know, if followed, have said that these things can operate in a particular way, and that's, again, our job is to ensure compliance.
Do you think Ohio holds those dropout recovery schools accountable enough?
You know, this is one of those areas that got some attention several years back when the state was wrestling with, you know, laws around charter schools generally. And I think there was some understanding that these schools have to be treated differently, but it wasn't exactly clear. And so there were some study groups commissioned to do some work around, you know, what should the accountability systems look like for these particular schools? And I think there's some work that can be done in that area.
Ohio is among a handful of states that allow students to have multiple student ID numbers. Most other states require a student one number. So you go through the whole system and you're always using the same number, whether you're going to Worthington City Schools or Columbus City Schools or wherever you might be, or ECOT or whatever charter school you might be working through. State Auditor Dave Yost and others have raised lots of concerns about the school funding implications of this apparently common practice of creating duplicate or multiple student ID numbers for the same student. This has been raised multiple times over the years. It just seems like such a simple fix. Why in the world doesn't Ohio have one number, like equivalent to a Social Security number?
Actually, we do. It was interesting the way you phrased that, because Ohio law actually requires that you only have one number. And in fact, there are a number of controls. When this first came up, it was actually, I want to say, maybe even 15 years ago. And there have been a number of things put into place to control the issuance of those student identifiers, to the point where it's relatively rare where that happens. You know, we do still get people that say it happens with some regularity, but every time we look into that, you know, we find that not to be the case.
Well, we've got Dave Yost said that it happened during testimony on Senate Bill 2, the state auditor.
Yeah. And do you, I mean, how long ago was that?
Well, it's in 2012, 2013, not that long ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
again, I wasn't here at that particular time.
Didn't
number. Follow
it. It's supposed to be one number.
And
all
there,
the
are
way
checks,
through.
There are checks. There's a contractor who's actually the gatekeeper, shall we say, for all the student identification number work. And they have rigid requirements pursuant to their agreements with us and pursuant to state law to, you know, do checks to make sure students aren't issued multiple IDs. Now, sometimes when that happens, though, when people will pick it up externally, and when those things are reported, we also go back in and reconcile those so that all, you know, that there's only one recognized student identifier for the student.
So now that all the ECOT, you know, I know you're in litigation with ECOT, all that being equal, how does the Department of Education calculate e-school enrollment now?
Well, what we require, you know, it's rather than us calculating, it's the record keeping that we require of e-schools to maintain in order to show that the students are in fact engaging in educational opportunities, you know, consistent with state law. So that's you know, that's been the requirement on the books, and that's what we're enforcing.
Going to turn to a few callers right now. Frank in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Frank.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I learned a trade in the late 70s at a vocational school. It was a public vocational school in Ohio. And a year or so ago, I was talking to some staff members so I could, like, recommend to people that I see for their children about attending a vocational school. And I got the impression, like, the vocational schools now, like, let's say you wanted to have an engine replaced on a vehicle that was, you know, but maybe there's a shop, and I got the impression that the instructors don't even have the students long enough to give the thorough vocational training. And I got the impression it has something to do with this one child left behind, all this testing and things.
No child left behind.
It's just kind of real discouraging. It's just, like, I look at these charter schools, they're not building vocational schools. They're after renting from themselves and making money, and something needs to change. I don't know what it would be, but
let's see what Paula
has closed most of their vocational schools. We got like one or two left, and I know the enrollment's dropped, but okay. I think we need to bring that back.
All right. Frank, thanks a lot for that call. Vocational education, it's getting a lot of conversation these days, but...
Yeah, but let me tell you. So career technical education is the best kept secret in the state of Ohio. I would, if you have impressions about what goes on in career technical education, I would go and visit one, and your socks will be knocked off. I mean, it's fabulous. I totally disagree with the time issue. These are rigorous 2-year programs in our career technical education areas. And in fact, I visited a number of automotive technology programs, and the kids are tearing things down and putting things together, and they're top to bottom with well qualified instructors. And what I love is, in virtually every place that I go, they have these relationships with all the car dealers and the auto body shops and what have you. And and these kids, they gain these skills, they get the nationally recognized certifications, and then they're out there making a good living in a growing area. What happens though is people aren't always aware. And there tends to be this cultural bias that, well, you know, career technical education isn't college track, but it is college track. The evidence actually shows that those kids actually do better in college. They go on to get their associate's degree in their particular career area. Then there are routes to get even a bachelor's degree, master's degree, PhDs. If you're in like welding, you can end up getting a PhD in, you know, materials joining science. And just, you know, that career path is huge. And this, the kids that want to have a much more engaged learning experience, and the ones that are, you know, learn better in that kind of setting, they are, you know, they prosper and thrive in these career technical settings. I was just at the Career Tech Center that Columbus Public Schools runs, and they're, you know, and they keep, you know, reaching out and recruiting kids. And every time I have a chance to interact with people, I say, go visit these programs, encourage students to go there, because it is not, you know, it's no less. If anything, it's got advantages to it that outstrip, you know, what's happening in traditional classrooms, and there are fantastic things going on.
All right, we're going to continue our conversation. My guest is the State Superintendent of Public Instruction at the Ohio Department of Education, Paolo Di Maria. We've got a few calls to get to. If you want to give us a call, 614-292-8513. If you want to email us, you can. The address is allsides@wosu.org, or you can check out our Facebook page. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about Ohio education, as in public education K through 12 this hour. Still with us is the State Superintendent of Public Instruction at the Ohio Department of Education, Paolo Di Maria. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Last fall, educators suggested that 30% of the class of 2018 wouldn't graduate under the previous system adopted by the Ohio General Assembly in 2014. And that required students to score 18 of a possible 35 points on an end-of-course exam. Now it's correct me if I'm wrong, they don't have to pass the exams. They can still graduate by meeting any two of nine other requirements. Is this, and we can go over those, but is this a temporary fix to keep those 2 or 3 year gap year students from falling through the cracks?
Right. So, like you said, the data analysis really was around the class of 2018. And the class of 2018 is the first class to sort of be in the midst of this transition to higher standards, to different testing.
From
and
the
in
beginning.
Fact, you know, two tests changed there in fairly rapid succession. You know, I'm always a little bit of a stickler for precision in language. You talked about passing the tests, and there are actually seven tests. You don't have to pass them all. Some of them you can score proficient. Some of them you can score basic. And at the end of the day, you have to score this 18-point structure.
The more we looked at it,
because what I like about it is it does acknowledge that some kids are going to be better at some things than others. And so if you happen to be stronger in English and less strong in biology, you know, there the 18-point idea helps accommodate that, and I think that's a good feature of the system. At the same time, we found that there were a number of students that weren't gonna reach those goals based on our projections, and so you know the idea was, can we design something that allows additional opportunities for students to graduate and still maintain some sense of meaningfulness to those activities for ultimately going to college or the workforce or what have you. So this notion was, you still have to take the tests, and in fact, you still have to retake the ones that you don't score very well on. If you score at the lowest levels, you have to retake them, and then you have from this menu of options, you have to meet two. And again, you know, we still believe, as we believed before, that the vast majority of students are gonna do fine on the tests and graduate under that provision. There's also a career tech piece that's at play in all this as well. And then this will be reserved for those students that are really, they're completing all their classes, they're passing all the classes, because that's the other thing sometimes people forget, that you still have to complete the state minimum 20 credit hours of 4 units of English, 4 units of math, and so forth and so on, to get your diploma. And so this gives people a few additional opportunities to graduate. And now the real challenge is to look at, in fact, we're just going to be looking at the data for the class of 2019, and figure out whether we need to reshape the graduation requirements just to be a little bit more sensitive to, what the future holds.
How many years do you think this is going to go on?
Well, some of it, there's actually a fundamental issue embedded in all this, and that's the extent to which we should rely exclusively on standardized testing as the mode of allowing students to demonstrate what they know and are able to do to drive a diploma. I think increasingly people are saying, well, wait a minute, there are other ways that students should be able to demonstrate what they know and are able to do beyond standardized testing. Shouldn't we be willing to entertain, some of those things? And what might that be like? So the bigger design question from a policy perspective is, are there features of the graduation system that ought to be recognizing of those other approaches? Is it, senior year capstone projects? Is it, other demonstrations through, portfolios that a student accumulates during their academic career that allows you to say, based on this, we think that student has mastered what they need to know and be able to do in order to get a diploma from Ohio and then go on to a college or into the workforce.
Heather in Reynoldsburg, you're on the air. Hi, Heather.
Hi. My question was regarding there are STEM schools in elementary and middle school levels right now in Ohio, and I know that one of them just received the National Blue Ribbon Award from the Board of Education, U.S. Department of Education, and I was wondering if there are any plans to continue adding more STEM elementary schools and middle schools, or transitioning other public schools into those.
STEM being science, technology, engineering, and math, and arts, and other
right.
STEAM.
Sometimes they're STEAM.
STEAM.
Right?
Sometimes it's STEAM. So, what about that?
Definitely. I mean, the state. The state has a program where each year. In fact, several months ago, we just came off the new year of authorizing new STEM designations. In fact, I'm going to be up at a school later this week presenting their banner that they get to put in their hallway and recognizing them for their STEM designation. I think we're in the midst of the next cycle. We ultimately leave it up to schools and districts to decide if they want to be STEM programs, and then there's an application accreditation process. We partner with Battelle in terms of evaluating them, whether they're meeting the standard for what has been set for being a STEM designated school. And then we make those designations generally once a year. So, yeah, we're excited about the schools that have been designated and looking forward to many more being designated. Because, again, going back to this idea of, you know, what's the instructional program at the school and how significantly that contributes to the academic conditions and the conditions of learning, frankly, for students. STEM programs have been proven, you know, to be great in terms of meeting students' needs.
Thanks, Heather, for that call. 5 years ago, the Columbus Dispatch revealed that Columbus school administrators were retroactively altering thousands of attendance records at the end of each school year. And so far, the Ohio Department of Education has disciplined 16 of the 64 administrators suspected of falsifying data. 35 of those are still working in the district. What is the state's priority on this issue?
Well, you know, we address issues of, these kinds of issues in two ways. In the Columbus case specifically, you know, we took the highest priority first, and we are in the process of addressing the ones that remain. The other issue here is due process, making sure people have the right opportunity to make their case. And I think that
5 years.
Sure. I mean, it was a large case. And, I think we're pretty much at the end of the process.
But will we know that because of the way the state reports disciplinary action?
Well, at the end of the day, we have to comport ourselves in the manner prescribed by law. And that's, the way it is. The auditor's office has said they're going to be coming in and doing some reviews of our professional conduct services. We're always welcoming of advice in terms of improving our practices and functions. But we think we're doing things in compliance with state law.
Your predecessor, Richard Ross, said that they violated state law and threatened in April 2014 to permanently revoke the licenses of those district officials who had participated in that data scrubbing. What happened to that movement?
Well, I think, the bottom line is it's not for any one individual to decide whether someone's broken the law or not. There's a process. And we have an entire unit around professional conduct, everything from teachers who might do something inappropriate to the people that we're talking about in this case. There are well-prescribed, well-established procedures pursuant to state law because this is a quasi-judicial function, right? We're going to take someone's license away, and we have to take that seriously and be very deliberate about it. And so the process unfolds in the course of the work. And ultimately, it's that process that decides whether somebody, is guilty or not, and whether they should have their license revoked. And then, if circumstances dictate that, then if there are criminal issues or what have you, those get shared with the prosecutor's office.
And that would be on the school district or on the state to share those with the prosecutor's office.
It happens both ways. There's some times when things come to the attention of the prosecutor's office that don't go through our shop, and there are other times when we're the ones that bring it to the attention of the prosecutor.
If an investigation took as long as 5 years for a prosecutor to go through, I think people would be up in arms. I mean, what takes so long to do this?
Again, the specifics of the case.
Dave Yost compared it to being on death row. It's taken that long.
Yeah. Again, it's legal processes and procedures, and taking the cases in the.
Are there enough resources? Is it a shortage of resources in the Ohio Department of Education? Because there's lots of other disciplinary issues afoot well.
Yeah, I'm not a believer that it's a resource issue right now.
Sarah in Dublin, you're on the air. Hi, Sarah.
Hi there. So I wanted to ask about PSEO, which stands for Post-Secondary Enrollment Option. I was enrolled in that in my junior and senior year of high school, and I did it through Columbus State Community College. I was able to save myself a ton of money through college after I graduated.
Fantastic.
And then I ended up graduating college a year earlier than everyone else.
Oh, great,
high school.
Great.
So I was just wondering, I had to hear about it through a friend that was like enrolled in it. So why are we not, educating people about it, letting kids know that it exists more?
It's a good question, Sarah, and thanks for calling. First of all, when somebody does participate in the post-secondary option, who's actually footing the bill? Because there is a cost. Somebody's paying for it. Is it the district?
So we have to start by changing our terminology because it's now called College Credit Plus.
Okay.
College Credit Plus is the name of the program, and it was developed sort of in response, recognizing all the good things that PSEO was doing, but also wanting to kind of amp it up a little bit and address some of the shortcomings in PSEO. One of those, to the caller's point, is making sure, and this, you know, that's actually required in law, that students be given information by the school district and by their school about, you know, how they can engage in College Credit Plus.
But what form that takes sometimes can be...
Right. But still, you know, I think school districts take that seriously. And they understand that, again, going back to this issue of competition, sometimes, you know, they've got AP classes, they've got other things going on. But they, you know, they feel like it's important to make sure students, just like the college experience, you know, this is a good thing. This can be helpful to students, that can save them money, put them on a right, you know, a good path in terms of shortening their college experience. And so the notification requirements, people do, you know, comply with those and make sure the information gets to students.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and again, so your comment about the payment, both PSEO and now College Credit Plus are, you know, are derivative from a contribution made by the school district to the, you know, to offset the cost. At the same time, the higher education system usually is not charging full tuition. So it, you could argue it's a little bit of a, it's a shared funding approach, because the school contributes a certain amount, and then and it's a lesser amount than the normal.
And the college
tuition
charges the districts a lower amount than they would if the kid took it.
Right.
And that's one fewer child in a classroom. So.
Right. And again, you know, so one can debate whether the margin, you know, are you really saving anything if one student is taking one course? But at the same time, when you have multiple students taking multiple courses, you know, it's expected that. And again, a lot of the people, administrators I talk to aren't so focused on, are we actually, you know, they do it because it's the right thing to do for students, and it gives their students an opportunity to get ready for what comes after high school.
And it's called College Credit Plus now.
That's right.
Thanks a lot, Sarah, for that call. Bill in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Bill.
Hi. We know that thousands of Ohio students get a high school diploma, then they go to college, and then the college has, you need remedial math classes, you need remedial English classes. You're really subpar in what you know. I want to ask your guest, does this show that our high school graduation standards are too tough and need a lot of accommodations to let people get their high school diploma anyway? Or does it show that our high school graduation standards are too weak?
Yeah, why is it? That's such a big problem. The number in universities, colleges and universities talk about it all the time, that there's too many remedial level courses being required of them before they can even get to their general, you know, the regular curriculum.
Right. So the bottom line is, I think a lot of what we're seeing now, that both the change to the new standards as well as the use of the new assessments, these new graduation requirements, are all designed to help reduce the number of students that go into a college setting needing remediation. I think the second half of the story that a lot of people don't understand is that the way colleges deliver remediation is now being addressed nationwide, because people have finally figured out that it's not particularly effective, that in fact kids get caught into a remedial track and they actually never get to the point where they're college ready and never take those college credit bearing courses. And so many colleges and universities, including several in Ohio, are beginning to say, well, wait a minute, these kids actually are ready to be successful. We need to do a better job of supporting them, going ahead and enrolling them in credit bearing courses and giving them the extra supports so they can master the math and English skills that they need to succeed in that class. And we're finding that to be very much more successful than the old traditional ways of remediation. So it's I don't want to discount the fact that the K-12 system has its shared part of this obligation, but I think the higher education community is also finding that it can do certain things to help ensure students are more likely to succeed when they first come on campus, and they may not quite have the skills in English and math at the level that they should. They can still put them on a trajectory to success.
Bill in Clintonville, thanks a lot for that call. That is all the time we have. Paolo DiMaria, I hope you'll join us again sometime.
Yeah, let's do it.
Soon. And, you know, we'll catch up on more news in the Ohio Department of Education. Thanks for your time today.
It's great being with you, Ann. Thanks a lot.
Paolo DiMaria is the State Superintendent of Public Instruction at the Ohio Department of Education. Thanks a lot for listening today. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.